Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison has just published a new novel called Paradise, which she says represents the final installment in a three-book trilogy, begun with Beloved in 1987 and followed by Jazz in 1992. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that the trilogy is marked not only by Morrison's astonishingly lyric use of language, but also by some of the weaknesses of her worldview.
Time magazine recently ran a flattering cover story about Toni Morrison and her new novel, Paradise. The headline of the story, however, was an ironic testament to the dumbing down of America. It read, "The Sound and Fury of Toni Morrison." Clearly, the editor's intention was to pay homage to Morrison by invoking the title of a great novel written by one of her literary muses, William Faulkner. But of course, Faulkner himself lifted that title from Shakespeare, specifically from Macbeth's speech about a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Not exactly the most complimentary lines to apply to Morrison and her work. Surely, I thought, one of those ex-English major editors at Time should have known the Shakespearean allusion and killed that headline. Now, though, after reading Paradise, that Time headline doesn't seem like such a big gaffe after all. Certainly, Morrison is no idiot, and there is a grandness to her writing that commands deserved attention. Like the Shakespeare poaching Faulkner, she aims for the big effect, borrowing biblical language and intermixing it with down-home slang to imbue her novels with the booming voice of epic American literature. When her plots match the immensity of that voice, the effect is miraculous, as in her 1987 masterpiece, Beloved. But when her plots are too slight to warrant all that majestic rhetoric, Morrison comes off as top-lofty and pompous, like she did in her disappointing 1992 novel, Jazz, and, I'm afraid, as she does here in Paradise. All the sound and fury Morrison conjures up in Paradise certainly doesn't signify nothing. It just doesn't end up signifying nearly as much as it should. Paradise begins on an evil day in 1976 when 9 men from an all-black town in Oklahoma named Ruby get it into their heads that a group of women living on their own in a nearby self-styled convent are really a coven of witches responsible for all the town's troubles. The men organize a shooting party and murder the women. After this grisly opening, Paradise roams around in time, looking back to Ruby's distant origins in 1890, when a group of black families decided to journey together through Oklahoma in search of land. Here's a taste of Morrison's evocative description of that pilgrimage. All their belongings strapped to their backs or riding on their heads, young ones time-sharing shoes, raggedy as sauerkraut, they dreamed of clean clothes with buttons, shirts with both sleeves. Ruby eventually becomes a male-dominated oasis from racism, with no other house around for miles except the convent, a female oasis from men. She devotes separate chapters to each of the convent's inhabitants, among them Seneca, a rootless foster child, and Mavis, an abused wife who accidentally killed 2 of her children. All of these disparate stories, however, tend to diminish rather than fortify the total narrative effect of Paradise. The important question Morrison is exploring here is who gets to define and inhabit Paradise. Unfortunately, though, the belief in a mystical black female essentialism, a sense of genetic superiority that Stanley Crouch and other critics have argued undermines Morrison's writing, allows her a reflex answer here. Paradise, or at least heavenly moral authority, belongs exclusively to women. In this novel, they raise the dead, enlighten the living, and suffer emotional and physical martyrdom at the hands of their men. After their mass murder, the convent dwellers even manage to return to Earth as avenging Amazon spirits, tricked out in fatigues. Despite the many glorious passages that distinguish Paradise, Morrison's insistence on her heroine's divine election by right of their race and their double X chromosomes grows wearisome. In her next novel, I long for her trademark goddesses to rub shoulders with some dusky Lady Macbeths.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University.